This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And here again, I'm addressing those remarks as much to people who have a lot of learning experience as to people who haven't, because the learning experience generally, today...
Oh, thanks, I forgot about that. Thank you.
Learning generally today is taught as a subject. And it's a subject of the Lumei Kodesh. It's not taught exactly the same as other subjects, and every subject has its own discipline. But I'm going to explain to you what I mean by the fact that learning is not a subject. There are a few things that I mean. The one thing that I mean is that Gemara cannot be mastered. So that's not the reason that we do it. With other studies, other forms of knowledge and information, come inside. I wasn't expecting you to make it. Next time we're in session, we'll set up for more chairs. I wasn't very happy with the turnout. I wasn't expecting it. With other topics, there's an intention and an expectation that you master the material. Gemara, there is no such expectation. In fact, the starting point is the acknowledgement of the fact, firstly, that the material cannot be mastered. Secondly, that you are to be mastered by the material. That's the difference. And that is a 180-degree difference in the way we approach the subject. It's not there to master. It cannot be mastered. That doesn't mean you can't know the whole of Shas. You can know the whole of Shas. But you'll just know it and you'll discover that you're at the beginning of the next iteration and the next iteration and the next iteration. There is just no bottom to it. You're dealing with something which is Ein Sof. You're dealing with something which is limited, limitless, something which is infinite, and therefore an attempt to master it is a denial of the essence of what the Torah is. So that we have to understand right away. And that's why in yeshivas, for example, traditionally in yeshivas, there were no examinations. Because the purpose was not to gather information. The purpose was to mold the way you think. The purpose was to see the world differently. The purpose was to operate differently. So the purpose of learning is to actually change the way you think. Not just to change the way you think about Gemara, but to change the way you think about everything. Which means that learning Gemara requires emunah. Because you're actually surrendering your thinking process to a force. And you're saying, I'm willing to allow my thought process to be molded by a power that I don't fully understand or know. And that's the bitochen that is involved in the learning of Torah. If one comes into Torah saying, no, I'll decide here what I'm going to accept and what I'm not going to accept and how I'm going to approach it, and I'm going to bring my methodology into it, we're missing 99% of what the Torah has to offer. Because what the Torah really has to offer is, give yourself over to it. Allow yourself to be molded by the Torah. Don't try and mold the Torah. And that's the difference between orthodoxy in the true sense of the word. All these terms have become somewhat bastardized over a period of time. But orthodoxy in the true sense of the word, Torah, as opposed to some of the other branches, is that understanding up front. That I'm here to be molded by the Torah, I'm not here to mold the Torah. The Torah doesn't need any molding. And that requires a whole lot of humility. So that one of the first tools of learning, perhaps the most important tool of learning, and I'll tell you the second most, there are three important tools we're going to use. The first most important tool for learning is anova, humility. Whereas in many other subjects, you need some degree of almost arrogance. You need a certain degree of confidence to approach it and to say, I'm going to master it. I'm going to get on top of this. With Torah, you've got to come in saying, I know I never will. I know this cannot be mastered. Not only cannot this be mastered, but it will master me. And I'm okay with that. Because to be mastered by a divine force happens to be a privilege. And that's how we come into Torah. And that's why it's so different from anything else. The second important tool that we need for learning Gemara is a sense of humor. And we'll discuss a sense of humor. If you don't have a sense of humor, very hard to understand Gemara. And we'll see why as we get into this. You need a sense of humor. And the third thing is you need two fingers. And you use your two fingers. I notice there are a lot of people here who without texts. Next time, please get hold of texts. Let me know if you can't, and we'll arrange some photostats. You need the words in front of you, and we'll discuss why. And the reason you need two fingers is because there is a dual primary text in Torah, in Gemara. Rashi, the inner column, is a part of the primary text. You read it together with the Gemara. You're reading two texts simultaneously when you're learning Gemara. You don't learn one and then the other. You're actually learning two texts simultaneously, which is why in that shir, I think you referred to that I did about a year ago in the Beis Yaakov poll, when we talked about how the young generation is particularly suited to Gemara learning. Yeah. And part of that is because the younger generation, because of their being wired by a much more technological environment than we were wired by, thinks in parallel segments. They're able to keep track of parallel thinking structures in ways that older people find much more difficult. That hyperlinking is something else. In addition to hyperlinking, they can actually keep thinking along different tracks. So a young kid can be texting while he's writing and talking to his dad at the same time. And his dad says, "Won't you concentrate?" And he says, "I am." And he's busy texting to his friend. Literally, he's doing the three at the same time. And then we're taking him off to a psychologist. We put him on Ritalin because he's ADD. And he's not ADD. He's just, that's the way he's wired. As a young kid, he's wired to be able to do that, with its advantages and its disadvantages. But in Gemara, that's a necessity. So in Gemara, we're going to see, we are going to need to hold certain parallel structures in our heads as we work through them. But even before we get to parallel structures, to cognitive structures, just in terms of textual structures, Rashi is not a Perush. Rashi is not an explanation of the Gemara. Rashi is an integral part of Gemara text. So Rashi is part of the primary text. And we'll see that how that works. That's why you need two fingers, because the time it takes you to switch your attention from Gemara to Rashi and back to Gemara, you lose a trend of thought. So you need two fingers to keep one on the Rashi, one on the Tosfos, so that you can, and on the Gemara, so that you can switch backwards and forwards from the Rashi to the Gemara and the Gemara to the Rashi without losing a moment of attention, so that you can keep the string going. So we'll get used to that, and we'll get into that as it goes. Yes.
And what was the line of thinking until Rashi came out?
Rashi's merely recording the line of thinking that was orally passed on.
No, but when the Gemara was written down in the year 400 and Rashi was written 1100-700.
That's how they taught it. Rashi just recorded it. Rashi recorded the way Rabbeim were teaching Gemara forever. That's the way Gemara was teaching. It just wasn't written down.
Oh, they learned it.
They learned it that way.
Speak with Rashi.
That's exactly right.
Rashi
brilliantly recorded the absolute minimum necessary to stay on track. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't other ways to learn the Gemara, because every Gemara has dozens of different facets. But the question is, what is the platform? What is the springboard? Where do you start from? So you don't start from Gemara and then go to Rashi. You start from Gemara and Rashi, and then go to others. Okay, Gemara and Rashi is one. There is no Gemara without Rashi. Gemara, Rashi, that doesn't... Now, once you've got Gemara, Rashi, there are many different ways to mold your understanding of the Gemara, some of them different from Rashi. So we might move off Rashi, but that's the starting point. There's got to be a starting point, and the starting point isn't Gemara without Rashi. Because then the chances are we're going to be on some track that is going to be very hard for us to get off again, and when you start on a wrong track, it's very, very difficult. So Rashi's function is to keep us on the right track. Tosfos's function on the right-hand side is very different. So Tosfos's function is to make sure that any relevant hyperlink, yeah, that is, Tosfos is really a hyperlinker, is brought to our attention. So Tosfos is the hyperlink, but he goes far beyond the hyperlink. He actually articulates the challenges created by hyperlinks throughout the universe of Shas. And we'll see how that operates. So it's not just a hyperlink, it's saying there's a concept that you might not have thought was relevant at all to what you're learning, but hey, it is relevant, and if you understand the principle of that concept, you may have a challenge on this piece of Gemara. And that has to be addressed. So in terms of parallel structures, Tosfos takes us a whole lot further in trying to understand where we are in, and develops our capability of circular thinking. Circular thinking or spherical thinking is the thinking that I like to term as the Gemara's method of thinking, and that is it's not linear. It doesn't start at A and go to B and go to C and go to D. It starts at a point and it moves out like a sphere in all directions simultaneously. It starts at a central point and it moves out. And that's why the linear mind will often say, but what's this got to do with that? We were just talking about A, why are we now talking about Q? The answer is because there's a long way from A to Q if you look at it linearly. There's not a long way if you look at it spherically. So think of the reasoning as like the opposite of peeling an onion. You start at the kernel and we move out. And we're moving in all directions. And then we loop back again and we find the whole thing coming together. So it's just, these are examples of how our mind has to think differently. We cannot approach the Gemara with a secular methodology and expect the Gemara to mold our thinking into Torah thought. That won't happen. If you treat the Gemara like a secular subject, it will remain a secular subject and you'll study Talmud and you'll study Talmudic analysis and you might as well be studying Greek mythology. It's a great text. Very good, very interesting, a lot to teach, but it's just the text, that's all it's going to do. That's not what Torah study is for. Torah study is to mold the way you think and you to lead you into the divine. So learning is an avodas Hashem. Learning is part of our avodah, it's part of our service of God. There are three areas where we serve God. And the one is through the Maaseh HaMitzvahs, through the mitzvahs we do. Every mitzvah is a practice, it's a service of God. The other is through tefillah, avodah shebelev. We serve God through brachas and through tefillah. And in the second shiur, we'll start talking about brachas and how one says a bracha and what a bracha is all about. And the third one is through limud ha-Torah. Limud ha-Torah is one of the three pillars of spiritual practice. This is like davening. This is like doing any other mitzvah. You put on tefillin, you daven, you keep Shabbos, you go to the mikveh. Those are all spiritual practices. Learning is one of them. Learning is not the knowledge. This is not an academic part of it. This is an avodas Hashem. Because what this is doing, this apart from anything else, and Chaim Volozhin and many others, and Kabbalah speak about it a lot, it has the same impact on our souls as the mikveh does. It has a cleansing impact. It cleanses the way we think, cleanses the way we operate, it aligns our spiritual energy, aligns our spiritual energy within our souls, it aligns our spiritual energy between ourselves and between God, between ourselves and the world. So there's a spiritual transformation happening while we learn. That's why it's important to learn every day. It's important to learn every day, not because if you don't learn every day you won't cover enough ground. It's more important to learn a little bit every day than it is to learn a lot one day and nothing for 5 days thereafterwards. Because it's like davening. It's an ongoing spiritual practice. You go through transformation. You build. It's a development. It's like going to gym, building your muscles, and going through each time you do, you go a little bit further. So learning is a very unique experience, something very different from normal, from other forms of study, and more similar to other forms of avodas Hashem than it is to other forms of study. Furthermore, before we start just in terms of structure, we of course have the Chumash, we have the Tanakh, which is obviously the starting point, but not really. In the process of Limud HaTorah, the Tanakh is not the starting point. Because the Tanakh is just too concentrated. You can't really start with that. So our starting point is not even Mishnah, because Mishnah is also too concentrated. So Mishnah is the oral law articulated as case study. Very, very concentrated. Our starting point in the spherical reasoning is really Gemara. And from Gemara we go back to Mishnah and back to Chumash, and we go forward to Psak Halacha, to the actual halachic conclusions that need to be relevant up till this day. The relevance we get from Gemara is twofold. The practical relevance is halachic decision. So all of halacha, all of halachic decision is deduced from Gemara. There's no halachic decision that doesn't have its source in Gemara. And if it does, it's not halachic. If it doesn't, it's not halachic. So any halachic decision has its source in Gemara. And Then there's another level of relevance, and that is there are universal principles in each piece of Gemara that we can apply even in non-halachic ways. So we're going to be learning about slaves. There are halachot about slaves. There are sections in the Shulchan Aruch that deal with slaves, and we'll look at some of those as we go through that. But that's not why we're learning this, because we don't keep slaves today. That's not the relevance. The relevance to us will be, what are some of the universal principles of human relationships and relationships to man and God that we can deduce from the treatment, the halachic treatment of the laws of slavery in the particular Gemara that we're going to be learning. So that's the approach that we're going to do. Now what I want to do today is I want to get right into it, because otherwise we've got nothing to really get our teeth into. And we're going to start with a Mishnah at the top of Daf Yudalad Amud Beis. We'll refer back to the Chumash as the Gemara quotes the Chumash. We'll refer back to the parts of the Chumash that are necessary and relevant for us. And we're going to start this with four or five lines of Mishnah. We're not going to spend a long time understanding the Mishnah. So from the Mishnah, we'll move straight into the Gemara, and then we'll begin little by little to unravel it. Is my Gemara still there? We've taken it out. My Shas one. Maybe we can just use an extra.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks, huh? So over here, if we can have here, then we can, a few people can share, because that's a big one.
I would have trouble following it, so don't have to worry for me, Neil. I don't know.
Unless it's in English.
Sorry?
Unless it's in English.
But can you read Hebrew?
No. Well, I can't.
Can you follow in Hebrew?
I can.
Okay, then you follow. No one's going to ask you to read as long as you can follow. Do you know where to find your place in the Gemara? Okay, so this is Duff. Okay, this is where we're going to start reading from. That means the Mishnah starts. That's where the Gemara starts from. And we're going to start reading from there. Okay, so you'll just try and follow. And as we get into it more, you'll find it easier and easier to actually follow inside, even though you're not...
But there must be an English one.
Yes, they can get an art scroll that has an English translation alongside.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you read this?
That's a good idea. Okay, so let's have a look at the Mishnah. The Mishnah states the following. Eved Ivri, we're talking about an Eved Ivri. Now, a step back. The Masechta of Kiddushin, this tractate of Kiddushin, particularly the first part of Kiddushin, deals with methods of acquiring rights in human beings. Okay, now of course in our society that's already, we're already taken into another planet. But that's where we are. Remember, we're here to move into another world and to get our thinking molded into the world. We're not here to stand outside it and pass judgment about whether we arrogantly think that's a good idea or it isn't to have slaves. Right? That's irrelevant, whether we think it's a good idea or not to have slaves. Slaves are a halachic reality. They may not be a social reality, they may not be a political reality, they may never have existed. There are many cases in the Gemara of halachic situations that have never existed. That's not relevant. We're moving into a universe of concepts, and in the universe of concepts, there is a concept of slave, Eved. And there's a concept of human beings having rights in one another, commercial rights, tradable rights sometimes, in one another. Sometimes not tradable. What are the examples of where you've got rights in a fellow human being? So you've got a slave. And in the slave, we've got two categories. An Eved Ivri, a slave who is Jewish, and an Eved Kanani, a slave who is not Jewish. Right? What other cases do we have of rights of ownership in another human being? Marriage. Man has rights in a woman. Right? Does a woman have rights in a man? Well, to a degree, he has responsibilities towards her. He has to, but interestingly, he gives her a ksuba, which gives her certain rights, and the man as well. There's certain reciprocal rights. But the nature of the rights differ, and that's the first part of the Gemara which we're not touching right now. So there's Eved Ivri, Eved Kanani. There's Isha. What else is there?
Parenting children,
and children are not rights that are acquired. They are rights that are there through creation. So when you create something, you have ownership in it. And parents create children, so they have some degree of ownership and responsibility, but it has not something which is acquired, artificially acquired. All these other cases are artificially acquired. One of the other cases is Yavama, right? The case where a man dies without children, and his brother has certain rights to the widow, and there's that relationship, which is one of them. And there's the case of Amo Ivriya, which is a father could sell his daughter as a slave before she's 12. Okay, under the age of 12, he could sell his daughter as a slave. Now let's just pause there a moment, because I'll give you an example there of how something that looks despicable on the surface is in fact very beautiful. Because what was the reason, if one looks at that, why should there even have been such a concept of a man being able to sell his daughter as a slave?
Protection?
Well, what would be, not protection so much. That was the only way that it was possible to cross socioeconomic boundaries. So who would be the person selling the daughter? A rich family or a poor family? Poor family. Who would he sell to? A rich family. So this girl, with no hope of a future, finds herself as a domestic help in the home of a rich Jewish barabbas, who lives in a beautiful home in the nicer parts of Toronto, and she's all of a sudden moved out of this little slum in who knows where, and she's living in the lap of luxury, mixing with the family and friends of that family. And what is the Torah's intention?
Marriage.
Marriage. That is converted to a marriage relationship to one of the children or to the owner himself, if he was the one who bought it, or to one of his sons. So the intention is a transition from a life for a young girl doomed to poverty into a life potentially of marriage. That was her only ability to experience and be experienced by people who were in a completely different socioeconomic silo. And that was a very important facilitator, could have been an important facilitator. So when we talk about these things, there are many reasons why they're there, and we'll touch on some of them. But again, we're not here to pass judgment on the ethics of the Torah. We're here to put our minds into the Torah mind, into the mind of the Torah, and start reasoning and functioning like the Torah does. And the Mishnah says, Eved Ivri Nikne Bekesef Uvishtar. An Eved Ivri, so the subject of our discussion is an Eved Ivri, Jewish slave. There are cases, the Torah tells us, where a Jew can be sold as a slave. He can either sell himself as a slave, or he can be sold by the Beis Din as a slave. There's only one circumstance under which he's sold by the Beis Din as a slave, and that is when?
Theft,
and he doesn't have the money to repay. So we don't have jail. So you look at Eved, you say, oof, Eved, isn't that a bit primitive? Well, nowhere near as primitive as jail.
Yeah.
If you just think of what the concept of jail is, take somebody and lock them away. Can you think of anything more primitive than that? And that we're kind of comfortable with. That we do. That's the way we deal with these situations. In the Torah, there is no jail. Now, very, very rarely. There are a few cases of it. It's very rare. You've stolen from somebody, you can't pay, sell yourself. Okay, sell yourself into slavery. Lose your freedom, but don't lose your freedom to a jail. Lose your freedom to the person you owe the money to. Or to somebody else who'll pay you, and you'll be able to pay the person who sold you. So the loss of freedom is meaningful. The loss of freedom is not meaningless. So the Beis Din sells a Jewish slave if the slave is stolen and cannot repay. A person can sell himself as a slave if he's just very poor and just has debts and can't manage. So it's an economic out. He can sell himself as a slave, so he's taken care of. He has no requirements, a little bit like belonging to a trade union. So now you're taken care of. You know that you're secure. You can't be fired for the next 6 or 7 years or whatever the period of time it is left on the contract. And you're paid up front. Now, the beauty of it is, like a basketball player or a hockey player, you can be paid a whole lot of, you sign a contract and the value is determined up front. So you can actually capitalize on your labor. It's actually a brilliant economic tool for desperately poor people. So you can actually capitalize your labor on a net present value. You can actually work out the cash flow, you can give it a number, and you can trade that forward cash flow, you can retrieve the capital value and use that to relieve yourself of debt and work it off over a six-year period. That's what the idea of an EVID was.
In the case of theft, hypothetically it sounds interesting, but practically speaking, what person would ever want to hire a thief in their own house?
Well, you know, that's part of the that's part of the training of the Torah, that there's compassion too. People do funny things, they out of desperation they do things, and they can turn the corner and they can put themselves in a situation where they're able to do teshuva.
Not on the thief. I'm talking about the person who's
I understand, but he needs to be able to have compassion also for the thief to understand.
Both,
yeah,
both
absolutely, and understand this is a person who's willing to wants to pay back, who's willing to work for 7 years, for 6 years to pay back, and to give the person a chance.
Of judging a person fairly.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a Torah society where everyone wants to somehow connect and
Do the right thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is why we have trouble with that.
If it's a wicked person altogether, we have other ways of dealing with him. But the assumption is that at some point you're living in a society where the morality is so much a part of life that when somebody has stepped out of that, there's a desire for restitution. That person has a desire to come right again.
It's more like economic than what the person's motive was. We're assuming that he stole because he was poor, not because he likes stealing.
Yeah, it's quite interesting that not many people, when you're talking about the sophisticated criminal, most of the more petty crime is usually because they have an opportunity and they are deprived or feel deprived. How we deal with the more sophisticated criminal who takes a lot of people for a ride for a lot of money, not that such a thing could happen among the Jewish people, but but if it does, then we have different ways of handling that. So Eved Ivri nikne bekesef u'shtar. The chiddush of the Mishnah is that the way you buy him in Eved, how do you trade one? How do you get him? How does a person transfer from being a free man into a slave? What is the process? The Mishnah says you pay money. You buy him, you pay money. That's how it's done. Or bishtar, the same as you do it with land, same as you would do it with property. You buy with money, or you can buy with a shtar. But koine atzmoi, he can reclaim his freedom, b'shonim, if he's worked his number of years at the end of the 6-year contract, with a yovel, or by the yovel every 50th year interrupting the contract, that also ends the period. Uvegiroin kesef. And he can also buy his way back. If somebody is willing to come to his assistance, or he comes into money independently, he can buy his contract out, and he can go back into freedom. Yetera alav ama ha'ivriya. The ama ivriya, that's the young girl under 12, has an additional way of becoming free. Shekono es atzma b'simonim. She can also acquire her freedom by maturing. So if she reaches puberty before the age of 12, she goes free at that point as well. Hanirza, now we have another category of slave, and that is a slave who sold himself and now wants to carry on working longer than the 6 years for which he originally sold himself. So he can say, I want to stay with my master, and you know the case in the Torah, you take him to the doorpost and you pierce his ear, and he becomes a slave until the yovel. So he is acquired through the act of ritzia, of his ear being pierced against the door. And he acquires his freedom with the 50-year yovel. If the master dies, he does not get inherited by the children. If the owner dies, then he goes free. Now, we're going to be concerned with the first few words of the Mishnah, so don't worry about the rest of the Mishnah for the meanwhile. And just a word about Kinyan. Kinyan is a word the equivalent of which we probably don't have in any other language or legal system. And a Kinyan is the action that determines the moment of transfer. So the kinyan is not, they're very, very specific kinyan. For example, we can agree to purchase. I can agree to sell this pen to you for $5. There's not a sale yet. The pen still belongs to me. You can pay me the $5. The pen still belongs to me. The pen only transfers when you pick it up and you do a kinyan. You do a kinyan on the pen, then the pen transfers. That's what a kinyan is. So a kinyan is not the payment. Sometimes we use kesef as the kinyan. Kinyan is the moment of transfer, and there is an action combined with an intention that constitutes a kinyan. Every kinyan is a specific action with the intention for that specific action. So he's got to have in his mind that this is a kinyan. Otherwise it doesn't work. If his mind was the money was the kinyan, and he's just lifting up the pen because he's about to write, then it's still mine, still hasn't transferred. So you need intention. Why do you think you need intention? We've already agreed. We agreed we're selling it. He's paid me already. He's now picked it up, but without the intention of kinyan. Why does the pen still belong to me? What is that? What's happening?
So it's not an accident.
So it's not
an accident.
It's certainly not an accident. There certainly has to be intention. But let's go further than that. What does intention do?
Awareness of ownership.
So there would be an awareness and understanding that comes with that, that is an important element of it. But let's go even a step further. You see, in Jewish law, the transfer of ownership does not only have monetary implications. It has spiritual and halakhic implications. So for example, what are the halakhic implications? I take the pen and I use it to write with.
Stealing.
I've mm-hmm. stolen. If the pen is already his. Mm-hmm. If the pen is not his, I haven't stolen. If he writes with it without permission, he's just stolen. Geneva theft is a serious thing in the Torah. That's when we say on Yom Kippur, Ashamnu, Bagadnu, Gazalnu. That's Gazela. So what determines whether an action is theft or isn't theft? And I'm not talking about theft from a specific perspective of indebtedness, because there are two elements to theft, aren't there? There's an element of damages. I've stolen something from you, I need to compensate you. That's one side of theft. But there's a whole other side of theft. What is that? I've transgressed a law of the Torah. It's the same as breaking Shabbos. Mm-hmm. I've broken Shabbos. I've done something wrong. I have to do teshuva. It's not enough to pay him back. I've also got to do teshuva with God because I've damaged my soul. That's why kinyonim are so important. Kinyonim determine the effect on the soul of relationship with that object. If I'm the owner, the effect on my soul is nothing, is zero, it's one of ownership. If I'm not the owner and I'm using it without permission, that relationship damages my neshama. So the capacity of this pen to damage my neshama takes place by means of a kinyan. So kinyonim are very important spiritual concepts, not only halakhic concepts. When we talk about kinyonim, when we talk about a kinyan, we're talking about the energy that transfers, the complete change in, because ownership is one of the dimensions of an object. An object has its three physical dimensions, and it has a dimension in time, and it also has a dimension of sanctity, and part of the sanctity dimension is who owns it. There's a complete difference. We can see some very severe differences in ownership. One difference is, if you own the pen and I use it, I'm a ganav. And if I own the pen and you use it, you're a ganav. That's quite serious already. What happens if the Beis HaMikdash owns it and I use it? That's called me'ilah. That's even more serious. So ownership actually determines, it's one of the qualities of an object, is who owns it. The quality of the object. Just the shape can change. You know, you heat it and you melt it and you do it, you change the shape. When somebody else, it's not the same pen. When ownership changes, there's something about the pen that changes. There's something about its properties that change. And there are examples, not just in Jewish mysticism, but in other mysticisms too, where very sensitive people can detect ownership through the energy in an object. They can actually detect when something is stolen. They can detect when something belongs to one person or belongs to another thing. Our ownership of the things we associate with impacts the energy of that object, which in turn has an impact on our neshamas when we use that object, and therefore ownership is not just a civil issue and an issue of monetary law. Ownership becomes an important spiritual and halachic and Torah issue as well.
This cannot apply to a service. Right? You have a kinyan of a service, and an individual selling a service. So this would not apply to anything like that.
Well, great question. And to take the question even further, is an eved selling a service or selling himself as an object? Is he just selling a service or is he selling himself? And we're going to clarify that as we're going through. Is this just a forward sale of a labor contract? Am I simply saying, look, I'm selling my next 6 years of labor to you. I want money up front and I'm yours for 6 years. And I'm selling my service, or am I actually selling something of myself as a human being? In which case, I am a different category of being. Just as the pen is different if it's mine or if it's yours, so an eved is different from a free man. You've got different halachic, you've got a Kohen, you've got a Levi, you've got a Yisrael, you've got an Ish, you've got an Isha, you've got a Katan, and you've got a Gadol. These are different halachic concepts, not just different biological concepts. And you've got an Eved, and you've got a regular Yehudi, you've got a regular Israeli who's not an Eved. So the very concept of Eved is then created by this. So it's more than, you're absolutely right, it's more than just selling a service. This is actually selling something of oneself, and the term we're going to be using, the halachic term is there a kinyan haguf or not? Is there actually some form of physical possession and ownership that takes place in this? And if so, what is the nature of that and how does it operate? How do you own a human being? What of the human being can you own and do you own? Rachel?
I also like very much the structure of the Mishnah, because it begins with this very powerful concept you're talking about of kinyan that one person can have over another, which is very empowering, but it only spends four or five words on it, and then the whole rest of the Mishnah is telling you, but here's how you lose it.
Lovely observation.
It immediately sets the limitations into your mind that although this is very empowering, it should be balanced with that this is limited, there is a counter push.
Lovely observation, and that in fact is the predominant part of the Mishnah, is how do you terminate this? How do you turn around again? Mm-hmm. Yes, unfortunately, you can get yourself into a situation where the best thing for you is to become an Eved, but you've got to get out of that situation. The situation is not ideal, and there are ways to get out of the situation where being an Eved is no longer the best thing for you, or even a required thing for you, is where we would then get to. Yes,
Mark. And to a document. Is the document the kinyan?
In that case, the document is the kinyan and not the money. That doesn't mean that there isn't a price to be paid, but the moment of transfer... Yes, kesef, the first one is where the money is kinyan, and the second one is the money is the price, but not necessarily the kinyan. So money needs to be separated in our mind. Sometimes it's merely the price, and sometimes it's the kinyan. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's the kinyan and the price. So for example, I could agree to buy your house for $1 million, and I could give you $10 and say, this is the kinyan. So from this moment, the house is mine. I now owe you a debt of $999,000 or whatever it is. So the remaining price becomes a debt. It is no longer part of the kinyan. The kinyan is complete. Or we might say the kinyan will be shtar. I won't give you any money. We'll write a document. Your house transfers. And I now owe you $1 million. Mm-hmm. And that's a debt which you can claim from me. Okay. Let's move into the Gemara. So the Gemara's question is really, really important. And you see the style of question hundreds of times in the Gemara. And this is the way that we start off the sugya. Eved Ivri Nikne Bekesef.
What happened to Rashi? I thought the prerequisite earlier is that Rashi and the Gemara are completely in sync.
I'm assuming that while I'm reading, you're simultaneously reading the Rashi. I'm going to come to the Rashi. I'm going to come to the Rashi in a moment. It says the Gemara, Eved Ivri Nikne Bekesef, this which the Mishnah stated, an Eved Ivri can be acquired with money, Minala. Where from? So the beauty of this is the Gemara never taking anything for granted. It doesn't take for granted. It questions everything. And one of the beauties over there is how this in our culture, or this used to be part of our culture before we became so completely we become completely infected with the thinking of other religions. Our culture is built on questioning. And that's what avoids a fundamental religion such as ours becoming fundamentalist. Because we do have axioms, but we question everything. And we're taught, a child is taught to learn Gemara, 10, 12, 13 years old, a child is taught to learn Gemara, and the questioning process starts. The first thing you're taught in most other religions is what? Don't question. Don't ask questions. This is it. This is religion. This is faith. You just never see that with us. It's always a minnalon. Where does it come from? Where do you know from? How do you know from? How, if you say this, how can you say that? We're constantly questioning, but the art is to learn how to question. How do we question in ways that we retain our humility? How do we question in ways that we still allow our mind to be molded by the Torah and we're not molding the Torah? Because there are different types of questioning. You can stand outside and question, in which case the material will never change you. You trying to change the material. Or you can step inside and out of bewilderment question. That's a different kind of question. And what we're doing here is stepping right inside. Evidi v'unik neber kesef. That's an axiom. The Mishnah says so. Not questioning that. We know that Evidi can be nik neber kesef. The Mishnah's told us that. We don't even need the Torah. We've got the Mishnah that says that. As it happens, well, the Torah doesn't really say that, does it? The Torah doesn't say Evidi v'unik neber kesef. You won't find that phrase in the Torah. So what is our primary source for the fact that an Eved Ivri can be, that the kinyan for an Eved Ivri, the process that converts a man from a free man into an Eved, a spiritual conversion as much as an economic conversion, the thing that does that is the transfer of a koyan. That we know. Where do we know from? The Mishnah. The Mishnah is our primary source. We're not questioning that. We do want to know is minalon. Where does that come from? What is the origin of that statement? Where does the Mishnah get that from? And I'm just going to read the next piece, and then we will do the Rashi. Omar Kro, the Pasuk says, those of you who have Chumashim, it would be good to look up the Pasuk, and it's in Vayikro, Kafhei Nun Aleph, is that right? 25:51 in Vayikro. So that's right at the end of Bahar. And let's start reading from a little bit before that. Start reading from 47 from Mem Zayin. V'chi tasig yad ger v'tushav yimoch u'macha chicho yimoch. And if a man becomes poor and he's on the verge of financial collapse, and he lands up being purchased by a non-Jew living with you, v'nimkar legeto shivimo, and he is sold to this non-Jew who lives in your community or society, or la'eki mishpachat ger, or to any part of that non-Jew's family. Acharei nimkar, even after he's sold, ge'ulo tihiyelo, he does have the potential for redemption. As Rachel's comment about the Mishnah, we see in the psukim itself again. Immediately he's sold, but there's a way he can come back. Echod me echov yigoleno, one of his brethren should redeem him. We should not accept that situation of a Jew who, for force of circumstances, sold himself to a non-Jew. We should not accept that, and we should redeem that. We should redeem him, pay the non-Jew off, so that we can get the Jew back into freedom. Or dodo, vendodo, his uncle, or his cousin yigoleno, or misher besorim, mishpachto yigoleno, somebody from his close family, or his sigayoda, maybe he gets some money v'nigal, and with that he can redeem himself. V'chishav im konehu, and he should calculate with his buyer, the person who bought him, the non-Jew, mishnas himachro lo, from the year he was sold to him, ashnas hayovel, how long it would take to the year of the yovel, how much time is there left to work, v'yokesef mimkoro b'mispashonim, kimei socher yeimo, and recalculate it as if he was a hired hand retrospectively. So he sold his labor, let's say, for $50,000 for 50 years, 2 years off into the contract, he gets enough money to buy himself out. How much does he have to pay the owner? $48,000, because we would say it was $1,000 a year for the labor, 2 years have gone. That's how we'll calculate it.
He's enforced the yoke on the non-Jews.
Yes, he's bound by the same. Im oed rabois bashonim lefim yoshiv gulos. If there are many years to work, then he must pay accordingly. Mikesef miknoso. What does that word mean? Mikesef miknoso. Now, if you look at Unculus, those of you who've got Unculus, he translates it, Mikesaf Zavinohi. From the money, what does Zavinohi mean? Anybody recognize the word? From the Haggadah? Of the sale. The Zabin Abba, remember? Chad Gadian, the Zabin Abba betrays Zuzeh. The Zavinohi, the money of the sale. So Unculus is talking about the price, not the Kenyan. But kesef miknasoi, the use of the word miknasoi is unusual, and the Gemara wants to learn from that. If we now go back to the Gemara, Omar Kro, mikesef miknasoi, it uses the word miknasoi. What is the root of the word miknasoi? Kinyan. Isn't that so? Kinyan. Melameh, that comes to teach us, it didn't have to say mikesef miknasoi, it could just have said, You pay him back according to the years. The kesef miknasoi melameid shenikne bekesef tells us that the actual kinyan used up front was a kinyan of kesef. When the non-Jew acquired the rights in the Jewish slave, the action which converted the Jew from free man into slave was the transference of money. Quite apart from the price. Right? It's not money. Money, as we said, has two functions. There's the price for which the slave commands, that's his value, and there's the kinyan, and they may be two different amounts. The kinyan could be with a pruto, the kinyan could be with any coinage, no matter how small, and the price has to be the full value. So the Gemara learns, unlike the way Unculus translates it. Unculus translates it, this is the money, the price, the money for which he was bought. The Gemara translates it as the money by which he was bought. That's the difference. If it's the money by which he was bought, the money was the kinyan. If it was the money for which he was bought, the kinyan might have been shtar. The kinyan might have been something else. We don't know what the kinyan was. We know there was money paid. Of course, why else would he sell himself? Says Unculus, that's all we're talking about, the money that was paid, the value, the price. Gemara says no. Kesef miknoso means the money by which he was bought, not for which he was bought. And therefore we see from that, if that's how we translate kesef miknoso, we see from that that kesef is a valid kinyan. It's the way that ownership is transferred. Now let's look at the Rashi, and then we're going to have to leave it. So let's go through the Rashi on the Mishnah. Nikne bekesef uvishtar bigemara yalifla. The Gemara will learn where that comes from. Bashanim, Lesof Sheshonim Yotzei Chofshi, at the end of 6 years the slave goes free, that's what years means. Uve Yovel, Impoga Bo Yovel Betoch Shesh. Rashi uses a strange word which the Gemara uses over and over again. Impoga Bo Yovel, if the Yovel strikes him in the middle of his contract, as if this is kind of, wow, nobody knew it was coming. All of a sudden, hey, this Yovel, where did it come from? It's a very strange word, and we'll have an opportunity to examine why that terminology is used. But we see that over again. In Pogabo Yovel Betoch Shesh, if in the midst of his 6-year contract, the Yovel happened, he goes free even though the 6-year contract isn't yet complete. Uve Giro in Kesef. Interesting, just if you pause there for a moment, what do you think that means? Why would he have sold himself for 6 years if the Yovel's coming? So it's year one, the Yovel is year three, and he sold himself for 6 years. Why did the person buy him? Even though he was a non-Jew, surely he took some legal advice. And what did he do? Pay for 6 years of labor? And now he's going to go free after 3 years?
Isn't that the same concept of loaning somebody money, even if you know next year is yours, you still have to loan him?
So to take that a little further. So what you're saying, this man wants to be sold, he wants to sell himself, and the only unit of sale is 6 years. Yeah. You want to buy an Eved Ivri, you buy a 6-year contract, you have to buy him for that. He now goes out for Yovel, which means you've overpaid. What is his obligation? Is it too bad?
No, his obligation is the full price.
The non-Jew purchaser is, what about the slave?
The slave owes him the money.
The slave still owes him the labor. He's not, but not as a slave anymore, only as a laborer. Okay, so after the yovel, it's not as if he just walks away from the contract. You carry on working, but you're not a slave. And we'll look at some of the, so there's some benefits you lose and some benefits you gain. You were, you're now, you're a hired hand.
Is every contract 6 years?
So yes. 6 years is the slave contract.
If you only own them a tiny bit?
If you don't, if you only own them a tiny bit, there's quite an interesting question as to whether you, whether it even works, whether you can sell yourself as a slave. But it goes in six year units. So an important thing to bear in mind, that's why the pogah bo, that if the yovel hits you in the middle, you've bought 6 years. The yovel interrupts. All the yovel interrupts is your status as slave. It doesn't interrupt your obligation to work. So the obligation to work persists after the slavery is over in that particular case, which is interesting. We'll come to that in the further in the Gemara. But with Giro in Kesef, Podes Atzmo, he can redeem himself, Umagare Alo Adonomi Pidyono, and his owner has to deduct the payment from what he's already worked from the amount of the pidyon. So the owner does not have to say, I paid $10,000 for you, you want to go free, I want $10,000 back. The owner has to do the calculation and say, you only owe me $9,000 because you've worked for a certain amount of time. He should reduce the work, the value of the work of the years that have already passed. Everything according to the calculation of the money for which he was bought. As it says in Vayikra, and the price of his work should be according to the number of years. If he bought him for 600 and is going to leave after 6, we don't say the first years were more valuable because he's younger and stronger and his value goes down year by year. We just straight line it, and it's 100 per year, and that's how you calculate it.
We're assuming that non-Jewish people know all these technical laws? Or we're supposed to...
Well, you live in Canada. Do we assume that you know all the laws of Canada? Okay. No, you get a lawyer. So we assume that if a non-Jew is living in a Jewish legal system, he gets a lawyer who advises him before he does a contract. But yes, he does. If he is living in the Jewish system, the whole system functions according to those laws, whether one's Jewish or one isn't.
And ignorance of the law is not an excuse.
And ignorance of the law would not be accepted. Sorry?
If this is not talking about a situation where a Jew was bought by a non-Jewish owner,
right,
who functions in a non-Jewish system, the Jew wouldn't be able to get out at Yovel.
Yeah, well, the whole thing wouldn't work then. If you're working in a non-Jewish system, then everything wouldn't work. This is where the Jewish system is working. And you've got non-Jews as part of that Jewish system, mm-hmm, and they abide by the Jewish legal system. And not by the Jewish religious system, but by the Jewish legal system.
Mm-hmm.
So the Amo Evriya, the young girl, in addition to all of this, she gets a Besiman in Iris, as we learned previously on Daf Dalet. This comes to teach us that he does not work for the heirs. However, if a slave is sold for 6 years, and the owner dies within the 6 years, mashlimim leyorshov, he does carry on working for the yorshim.
Not as a slave.
Mashlimim, interesting question, whether it's as a slave or not as a slave. But he certainly has to carry on working. So if the 6 years are not up and the owner dies, the contract continues. If he's a nirtza, he's extended his contract for 50 years, and the owner dies, he does not have to work for the yorshim. The deal was only with the owner.
Mm-hmm.
Says the Rashi on the Gemara, the next piece of Rashi, Warren.
You just brought up the young girl. So now the young girl is 11, but she sold, is it also a 6-year contract?
No, she's sold only until she's 12.
It's a completely different
contract. Only until she's 12, by that, or if she matures before then,
yeah,
she's also out, or if the contract is converted into a marriage.
Okay. She cannot choose to continue working. She's done.
That's it, yeah.
So
she doesn't have that option.
Was intended, is she back to her poverty state?
Yes. If she's not married into the family, she's back into the poverty state. Mikesef miknosis, says Rashi, be'eved ivri hanimkar la'eved kechovim hakosuv medaber. This is going to be very important for the continuation of the Gemara. This verse that we learnt in Vayikra is talking about a Jew sold to a non-Jew. So there's a further subdivision in Eved Ivri. We said there's Eved Ivri and Eved Kanani, Jewish slave, non-Jewish slave. Now there are subdivisions of Eved Ivri. The one subdivision is, sells himself or sold by court. And the other subdivision is sold to Jew, sold to Gentile. So within Eved Ivri, we've got four subdivisions. Did he sell himself or was he sold by the Beis Din? Was he sold to a Jew or was he, did he sell himself to a Jew or to a non-Jew? Beis Din cannot sell him to a non-Jew. So, did he sell himself or was he sold by Beis Din? If he sold himself, was he sold to a Jew or did he sell himself to a non-Jew? Those are different categories of slave. And Rashi says, the one we're talking about here is a Jew sold to an Oved Kechovim, to a non-Jew. The Chitasi Yad Ger V'Toshov, as we learnt in the Chumash, that we learnt, we're talking about a situation of where a non-Jew purchases a slave. So that's the piece of Gemara as far as we're able to take it today, including the introduction to Gemara in general. And the next piece we're going to go into is, on the surface, it's going to be a technical analysis of the origins of these laws. Where do we get them from? These different slaves can be acquired by many. But in that process, we're going to be creating sets and subsets of slaves. Just different categories of slaves with slightly different angles to them. And we're going to understand these different angles and what it is that we can learn from them and what it is that we can understand from them.